People have asked me, when I give this talk, how much of this talk is going to be subject to new developments in astronomy that are emerging. And really none of it. The understandings that I'm going to pass to you that are based on the current understandings of modern astronomy are real fundamentals now. So the new shifts that are coming out of observation actually will contribute to my talk. There's really one wonderful new observation as of 2008 that's critical actually to establishing the idea of a galaxy as a minor sector. This is really wonderful. This is 2008. So there is some new stuff in the talk. But the fundamentals that I'm going to give you have been in place now for quite a few years and are not really going to alter the big picture that I want to try to present to you, to try to give you a way to reconcile what's going on in the apparent astronomy, the story of astronomy. It's not really the science of astronomy in the Urantia book, it's the story of astronomy. The Urantia book's giving us a story, and how to take that story in the Urantia book and try to make sense of it in relationship to modern astronomy. It took me a long time. I fumbled around with these images and decided you couldn't reconcile the two for the first 20 years that I was a reader. And then all of a sudden one day I had an aha moment, and from there it just developed. And now it's pretty clear to me what the heck is going on. It's really fun, actually. It's been a lot of fun watching things occur to me and watching developments take place. But this is fairly basic stuff. I'm really not going to be doing doing anything highfalutin in terms of astrophysics, though I'll touch on it a little bit here and there. I'm going to try only in little bits and pieces to get you up to date on what's happening in modern astrophysics, only as it relates to the Urantia book. We really have a lot of ground to cover. Because I'm going to tell you a story also. The Urantia book tells a story, and I have to tell you a story to get you up to date on how to reconcile the two. So I have to tell you a story so you can understand the story in the Urantia book. And this really isn't a talk oriented towards new readers. If you're a new reader, that's fine. But if you're an old reader, it's better. Because having some sense as to how the Urantia book covers the whole scheme of language and images really helps, but if you're not all that familiar, this will help you in any case. I did this I was at 533 a couple months ago. Gar Jameson invited me and a couple of other people to come and have our talks videotaped. It's really a wonderful idea that that I've attended so many talks. You've probably attended so many talks over the years that were fabulous talks, given once, given twice, gone forever. And Gard has realized that there's a lot of great talks out there that really deserve to be developed into a library, and that's what he started doing. Mark Erickson, I guess he's not here. Mark is recording this in audio. There is a DVD that's been produced in the last 2 months, and I had a couple copies and they're gone now. But you can get copies from Gard or from 533 or from me after the fact. And it was professionally produced. It was really well done. And I think for that occasion I was on the money rather than rambling. I'm going to try not to ramble once I get really rolling here. My point here is, though, that there is this. The talk is available on DVD. And it bounces between me and the screen. It was extremely well done. Eric Kosh is the one who did all the work. So what I want to tell you is, if you get lost, if you get space out, and I pass over some stuff that you've spaced out on, and it's not lost forever, because you can get a hold of the DVD, you can rewatch the DVD, it's all there. I'm really not doing anything different now that I was doing 2 months ago. It's basically the same elements of the talk. Another way to get at this is on the internet. So if you go to ubastronomy.com, the talk as I gave it in Los Angeles last year is sitting right there, and you can work your way through it slide by slide. You can listen to the audio or not listen to the audio. Maybe just for fun, I'm gonna try to bring that up and see what I can do here. just to give you a semblance of it. I've got two screens to work from here. I think I'll work from this screen. This is what you'll see when you get on the internet. You can contact me through this page. There are links to a couple of other wonderful pieces of software that I briefly want to show you that you can download using your own computer. You can ignore what's new because I haven't done anything new for too long. It's making me crazy. But under slideshows, there's a couple of possibilities here. I've only really got... You'll actually see a lot more screen real estate if you get on your own computer. Because of the nature of these LCD projectors, you only get a small amount of screen real estate here, which is unfortunate. But I've really only got two things up. The main talk is this one, where in the universe are we? And unfortunately, the screen real estate here is just terrible. What you can do... I just want to, I'm only showing this to you. Now I cannot see this. This is. Usually I have more time to be a little better organized in terms of how the room is set up, and I have not had the chance to do that today. Okay, this is the key to running the whole thing. You can turn on or turn off the audio. Audio is running right now. It's talking at me through my computer. You can turn off the audio and just work through it slide by slide by slide. And the slides are basically what you're going to see today. There's a few changes. The big thing about going to the internet that you can't get from me today and you can't get from the audio or the DVD is every slide that has a more information available thing at the bottom will allow you to go deeper with anything I'm talking about, because an hour and a half is a lot of information. Well, there's a lot more that I have to skip over. And you can grab some of it off the internet from these more information pages connected to each slide. So if for some reason after the fact, you know, you think there might be something useful in my talk that you want to know more about, you really have to get on the internet to see it. The one thing that I will do here is, how many people have tried Google Earth? No Google Earth. Okay, Google Earth, as you know, is an absolutely fabulous piece of software. Here we are at Dominican University. Let's see here. Anyway, so, you know, it's Dominican is just, Google Earth is absolutely just wonderful software. We can, just for fun, we'll go here. If you don't know Google Earth, it's really fun. How many of you guys have done this before? Just meandered around with Google Earth. So there's 533. There's the building. You can actually see cars parked. Mike Wood lives in the apartment up here, and there's two cars parked in front.
And there's also street views there.
Yeah, that's right. There are street views. The big thing here, the reason I'm bringing this up at all is because under Explore, Google Earth has added the sky and has added Mars, and they are absolutely incredible. And the Google Sky in particular, it used to be that to get a good piece of astronomy software, you'd have to go out and spend a couple $100. You can get the professional version of Google Earth for $400, but the free one is unbelievable. So just if you just do Explore and do Sky, this is the best you can possibly do. Microsoft also has something called Worldwide Telescope. If you go to my website under Links, you can go to Google Earth and anybody can go to Google and download it, but it actually shows the link for downloading Microsoft's. You know, Microsoft is trying to go after Google everywhere it can, and it has Microsoft's Worldwide Telescope. And so you can get that also off the web, and they are both fabulous pieces of software. I'm not even going to try to introduce you to it here. You really have to just going to have to play, and it is just a wonderful piece of software to play with. So, where in the universes are we? This is not an arbitrary choice of a galaxy. Is that too bright? This thing is really bright. This thing is crazy bright. Is this better? Is this better?
Yes.
Okay. This is not an arbitrary choice of galaxies. This is M51, actually. And it's a barred spiral galaxy. And it's come in recent years to represent what the Milky Way likely looks like. Let me tell you, this is real important for Urantia Book readers, because this is the image also of a minor sector with two great streams of stellar coils emerging from the middle. All right? When I used to give the talk originally, I would save most of my conclusions for the end. I'm not doing that anymore. I'm telling you what some of the conclusions are right from the beginning, so you can soak in them as we move through the talk. I would like, who's got a really loud, big voice that would like to read for me? I always have readers. I would love it. So anytime someone pops up here, something pops up here, Bob, just go ahead and just read for me, unless I stop you.
Universes, 1936, Webster's Universal Dictionary of World Syndicate Publishing Company. Definition, universe. Designates the massive worlds with everything associated with them, comprehending all stars, planets, satellites, comets, etc., regarded as one system.
Okay, so this is, if you do not in your study group have a 1930s dictionary, get one. They are really fun. They are really fun to go and read definitions that were in use at that time. Definitions of things like cult is really fun to see what that meant back in the 1930s and doesn't mean now. Definitions of evil, right, have completely changed. And here's another one. Universe, back in the 1930s, it simply meant the mass of worlds, with, you know, just everything. It sounds pretty much like what we're currently used to thinking, except that we really don't think in terms of universe anymore, as we don't think in terms of planets and satellites and comets. We think of universe as this huge monster big picture. Okay, so the connotations, mutations, everything has shifted a little bit. Doesn't seem to say anything about galaxies. Okay, this is a real important issue. Because in the mid-1930s, it's not using the word galaxies. Bob.
Definition, galaxy, the Milky Way, the long, white, luminous track which seems to encompass the heavens like a girdle, occasioned by a multitude of stars at so vast a distance as to be distinguishable apart only by the most powerful lenses, an island universe.
Yeah, an island universe, right? So the term universe...
And what year is this?
This is...
1936?
Yeah, it's 1936.
Okay, I thought you said they didn't say anything about galaxies.
It was not in common use, and we'll get to that.
Okay.
I'm going to develop that for a little bit for you. So with the Urantia book, we have a problem. We know too much compared to the 1930s. We have a use of language that conflicts with the use of language in the Urantia book. This is just critical. I know it took me so long to figure this one out. We treasure every word in the Urantia book. We treasure how every word hangs with every other word in the Urantia book, because it feels like you don't think about it. You feel a sense of authority. You feel a sense of hidden meaning and value hidden in the language. But the Revelatory Commission was stuck with the language in use at the time the book was coming forth. And so they had to make use of what the best they could, and they had to try their best they could to anticipate the use of language also. And here we are, you know, 70 years later, and language usage has shifted in ways that I'm sure the Revelatory Commission could not have anticipated. And language had to develop also. So the language of science needed to develop as well. And so that was some of what the Revelatory Commission was up against. And they did the best they could. But we have shifted meanings, and now when we use certain words, when we use words like universe and galaxy, we bring meanings to reading the Urantia book that were not in existence. And that's a problem. That really is a problem of understanding. So anyway, were galaxies, universes, Milky Ways, and nebulae distinguishable astronomically or by definition at the time of the appearance of the Urantia book? And this is what we really have to cover, is what was really visible. So at the time the book was written, universes, galaxies, Milky Ways, these concepts were used interchangeably in the Urantia book. Bob.
Page 1239.
You don't have to read those things.
Okay, yeah, just. You have also been informed that there are, in the process of organization, vast galaxies of universes far up beyond the periphery of the grand universe, in the first outer space level. We have not the slightest doubt that in due time these enormous galaxies will become inhabited universes.
Well, galaxies of universes. How crazy is that? You know, I mean, this kind of phrase, how many people have stumbled across that one and what? I mean, it's really there in the Urantia book. It really says galaxies of universes. And it's not crazy. Back if you're not living in the 1930s, that wasn't crazy. It's crazy now, but it wasn't crazy then. So the Revelatory Commission, they couldn't quite anticipate our use of terms. Somebody yesterday, which talk was it? David Kulicki's talk, and he mentioned the Ken Kaiserism. Who else was there at the talk with David's talk? It's a Kaiserism to go after numbers of words in the Urantia book, and this is really telling. It's really telling. How many? If you were to guess, how many times the word Milky Way is used in the Urantia book? Somebody throw a number out.
15.
Yeah, 7. How many times is the word galaxy or galaxies used? 21. Singular or plural, 21. Nebula or nebulae, how many times?
4.
56. How many times universe or universes?
3,000.
3,000. See, that's the problem that we have, is the term universe was everything. Galaxy comes from the Greek galaxios, way of milk. Milky Way, galaxy, same thing, no difference. The universe consisted entirely of the Milky Way. There was nothing more than the Milky Way as of pre-Hubble times. Okay, I'm going to back up a second. So I suppose almost everybody here looked through a telescope last night, right? You're all there. You know, so why... You know, so the joke is, why am I qualified to give this talk? Because my telescope is probably bigger than your telescope. I do have a background in physics, though I'm currently not employed doing physics, but I belong to an amazing collection of astronomers. You know, we're called amateurs, but we're the only ones who look at the sky. You know, the professionals don't get to look at the sky. They get to look at computer screens full of data that are coming from telescopes, and those telescopes don't even have ports on them to look through visually. The only thing that ports do is grab data from the sky and turn it into electrons that people look at on screens. So we're the guys that actually know the sky, can look at it and do something with it, and it's fun. Because here's the thing about the cosmic consciousness. I had such a good time standing out there last night watching you guys look through an eyepiece for the first time and really get a kick, really get that sense of awe that connects you with something larger. You get a little stilted. For me, I have to get out under really dark skies and to really get a chance to see things in all their glory. But for all you guys who were looking at it for the first time, the glory was right there last night from here in downtown Chicago. And it brings me back to when I was 7 years old. And I was 7 years old living on the south side of Chicago, which I left when I was 18 here. For some reason, in the course of, I have no idea why, but I was selling Christmas cards to relatives and door-to-door, and you got prizes, and I got a telescope. And I found the moons of Jupiter. I don't even remember why, but I did 4 years of high school science projects on the planet Jupiter. So last night was a kick. You know, thinking back to the fact that more than 50 years ago, there I was on the south side of Chicago looking at the same planet with the same moons, getting totally sucked into astronomy. And, you know, I didn't really get my first good telescope until, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. But that sense of connection with the universe that drives you, it's so sad, you know. I mean, it's just unbelievable that that the average school kid knows more about the universe, certainly than Galileo did. But back in those times, you could see the universe. You know, most of humanity is living in concentrations that have ruined the night sky. So you might be able to talk about it intellectually, but you can't connect with it anymore and see the glory of it unless you get out in the country and go look. But even then, most people you stand there under the night sky and you wonder at the glories of it, but you don't know the night sky. So our ancestors had the night sky every night, and they probably readily knew about these wanderers. Planet means wanderer, that there were these wanderers in the sky like Jupiter. And we're disconnected from that reality now. So in terms of cosmic consciousness, actually getting out there and looking. And so people like the guys in my club, and this is an average star party. Well, this is actually much bigger than average star party. And this is my real telescope. This is my 24-inch Starmaster that travels around in a trailer with me. But it doesn't take a monster scope like this to give you a wonderful look at the sky. So there's lots of other scopes that show up at star parties. I'm sitting here, and these are some of my club buddies sitting around here. We really have, it's very interesting to me that all these really incredibly techy, generally isolated, shy human beings bring their telescopes out and have a great time sharing the night sky with other people and making the universe apprehensible, which I think has a lot, something to do with cosmic consciousness. I think there's something there. So I'm not a professional. These guys are not professionals. The great thing is we're connected to the University of Michigan, and the university has given us essentially ownership rights to what used to be their research telescopes, because they don't use their optics anymore around Ann Arbor. So they said, if you guys want to maintain them and use them, great. And open the facilities up to the public, great. We don't have to pay you anything. And you're good public relations. So we get to do all that stuff. And we get exposed to the best minds in the world to come to the University of Michigan and tell us, you know, just give us their talk about what they're deriving from their observations. So I feel like I get the best of all worlds. I don't have to depend on, you know, doing research at the university to make my money, and, you know, I still get to keep up on all the astronomy stuff that's going on. So it's great for me to stand here with you and to distill that information in a way that I can actually try to homogenize it with the Urantia book. Bob.
This was the appearance and structure of the wheels. They sparkled like chrysolite, and all four looked alike. Each appeared to be made like a wheel, intersecting a wheel.
This is a wonderful woodcut that you've probably seen before. It happens to be colorized in this photo, but this woodcut comes out of the Middle Ages. I don't think there's even a date that's given for this woodcut. I love this image. You know, you've got the shepherd boy who's doing a cosmic consciousness thing. Boy, he's got, his mind is being stretched. His soul is taking in the universe in this image. I mean, you can feel, whoever did this woodcut was plugged in. Someone was plugged in here. Well, there was really no concept of stars as bodies out there. They were simply lights in the bowl of the sky. It's kind of fun to see them portrayed as, you know, six-pointed, because we never portray stars as 6 points anymore. It's always 5 points or 4 points. It's never six. But so that was the image. There were lights in the sky. And our shepherd boy here is having his cosmic conscious experience, and he is experiencing something. He's visualizing something, and you can never tell somebody that they didn't see what they saw. The question is the interpretation of what you saw. Okay, so at the time that this shepherd boy is gazing at the sky, whatever wheels he was looking at were probably interpretable in terms of scripture. So Scripture describes Ezekiel's wheels. So in modern day terms, who knows what this kid was seeing? Maybe he was glimpsing galaxies. See these huge wheels, right? I mean, who knows? Maybe he was being given a vision of something up close and personal like a galaxy. Or maybe a UFO. I don't know. But he was being given this amazing gift of visualizing something and experiencing a kind of cosmic consciousness. But this is a mix of story, it's a mix of cosmic consciousness, and it's a mix of science, because science hardly had gone anywhere. You couldn't really take them apart. And so the early science guys like Newton, they were first alchemists and secondly scientists. Everything was mixed together. The days of superstition were really in, you know, really were running up until modern times. It was all mixed together. You couldn't take it apart. And so that was the story of that time, and we need stories. We need our mythologies to explain, because we want to explain our experiences. And so this is the explanation for his experience, is this kind of thing. Every culture has had its stories. This is this funny little great image in the Hindu system of the world supported on an elephant standing on a tortoise. This comic is kind of fun. Bob, go ahead.
Wow. Little Eagle's been telling me the story of how his tribe got started with the help of the bears, buffalo, and eagles.
Oh, yeah, those are just old myths.
That's the trouble with you Europeans. You think just because something never happened that it's not true. All of man's universe romancing may not be fact, but much, very much, is truth.
Yeah, I don't know where this comes from. A myth explained is a myth drained, and the Urantia book is, you know, is just rife with stories. And who knows if we'll ever find Fandors, you know, we don't know that. And who knows if some of the stories about Endon and Fonda really happen exactly. But, there's a truth contained within these stories, right? And so story is real important. And here's our story, right? This is our story. The Urantia book is an amazing storytelling vehicle. So we've walked from the Middle Ages through a bunch of stories into this time, and now we have this wonderful story. What did I just do here? Bob.
From the pre-scientific, pre-20th century journey of all religious systems to a nebulous heaven over the earth, the Urantia book's tale of a scientifically comprehensible journey across countless worlds and galaxies of space to a paradise beyond space and time. The fascination of the Hubble Space Telescope images could draw mankind to this new retelling of our destiny amidst a fully inhabited universe.
Yeah, who is God among the galaxies instead of the heavens? You know, that's the treasure of the story that we have to tell. Urantia book wants to tell us about not just God, but who is God among the galaxies. And so we have this wonderful story. And, you know, it's just so obvious how fascinated people are by the science, by the science of astronomy. What I need to do now is I want to just get everybody up to speed quickly using another piece of software altogether, just to show you how the universe works. If you're getting lost with something fundamental about what I'm telling you, raise a hand, okay? And I'll try to answer brief questions. To have longer conversation, because we don't have a lot of time, to have a longer conversation about this stuff, I'll try to do some questions after I finish, but anybody that wants to sit around at lunch and have a longer conversation, that'd be a great time. You know, so if you want to hang on to questions or whatever you want to just chat about, lunchtime might be a really great time. So, but I don't want anybody to get like really lost or something with something that's fundamental that I could cover right now and just knock it off and maybe to answer somebody else's question. This piece of software is really a kick. Again, here's this very same M51 image of a barred spiral galaxy, and all these little dots surrounding our Milky Way are not stars. These are all galaxies. Has anybody seen this before? Okay, probably some of you have seen this before. This piece of So I'm basically just, I'm taking the Milky Way and I'm rotating the Milky Way in space, and if you look off to the side here, this is the large Magellanic Cloud sitting off to the bottom. There's our nearest neighbor, the Andromeda Galaxy. Let's go visit our neighbor. Yeah, isn't this a kick? It's a great little piece of software. Yeah, see, these are, yeah, isn't this great? And so these are all little, all these things are galaxies. Everything that we're looking at here is galaxies. So what the what this piece of software is a collection of 28,000 galaxies within a 700 million light-year cube. And the reason I can do that, this is actually getting to be fairly old. This is like 10 years old now. But to get good redshift data is tough, to actually know exactly how far things are out there. But this, these 28,000 galaxies, they can collect enough information on to create a nice mapping. So this will give you a sense of the mapping of the universe. There's very few stars in this image. Just for fun, we're going to go home here. What I want you to look at is at the bottom of the screen. See, it says distance from the sun. So we have 12,598 light years. So we're getting in closer and closer and closer and closer. So now we're getting down to 300 light years. And at 300 light years, this is the Small Magellanic Cloud. We're getting in pretty close to the solar system. We'll just keep going here. We'll just keep dropping in. So now we're 5.44 astronomical units, 5 times the distance of the Earth to the Sun. Wham! It's on the Sun. The one thing that's really fun to take the time to do, and we can't take the time to do it, even though I'd love to take the time to do it, is, you know, I can even grab the solar system here and show you something about the orientation of our solar system in relationship to the background stuff out there. So here's the Small Magellanic Cloud and the Large Magellanic Cloud. The small galaxy neighbors that we can only see from the southern hemisphere. But I wanted to give you a sense. So now we've gone as far in as we can go. We're gonna go out. So watch the bottom of the screen here. So we're zipping out. Here is where we get to the point where we're at 678 million light years. This is the extent of this collection of galaxies. The universe is currently understood to be about 13.7 billion years old. So we're really only here in this image. We're not even a billion light years out, which is, we're still relatively nearby in this image. And so as you look at this image, there's something about this. You can get a sense here as to how galaxies are strung out in something other than a nice homogeneous fashion. So if you think back to the times of Albert Einstein, they had the concept then, we'll get to this a little bit later, was that the universe was homogeneous. The universe as we currently understand it is a lot crazier than Einstein and those early guys would have ever guessed. They really thought the universe was somehow kind of homogeneous, but the universe is a really crazy place. They couldn't see it at the time. There's a real problem in astronomy, and the real problem is this problem right here. See how this whole thing looks brain-like, like a two-lobe brain? Okay, who wants to give me an answer as to why this is a very dark-looking area right here? Who's got an answer for me?
Two clusters past each other?
Black hole?
No, it's really simple. It's a really simple answer. If we are in the middle of the whole thing, and we're mapping everything that's out here, from our perspective, why is this all dark right here? Why is nothing mapped? This is actually really important, even from the point of view of the Arrangement book. It's really simple. The night sky, when you're looking up towards the Milky Way, the plane of the Milky Way is like this, and we're looking it, to get data about anything out here. It's screened by the Milky Way. The Milky Way is completely blocking anything that's out here. And that's real important, because what the Arrangement book says is if you're looking through the plane of the Milky Way, you're looking through toward the center of all things. Well, guess what? If you're looking toward the center of all things, and it might be over here somewhere, we can't get data. We can't get very good data, because it's buried behind the plane of the Milky Way, behind the stars in the Milky Way. So that's what we're seeing right here. So I wanted to, because this is important, this figures into the talk, and I want to make sure you guys have a sense as to what's going on here and something that's problematic. As we continue out farther, what we get into are artistic renditions of galaxy clustering. So here's the brain right here. There's our brain. But beyond the brain of this local collection of galaxies, we start seeing clustering, super clusterings of galaxies. So only since the 1980s has this large-scale motion, this large-scale gravitationally bound groups of clusters have been discovered. This is you know, 20 years. This is not long ago. And when people ask me about the Big Bang and the Urantia book, the Big Bang is not just embedded in modern astronomy. It is so solidly, we are so stuck with the Big Bang as Urantia book readers, we have to consider how the Big Bang itself might relate to it. And I'll mention it right here. This is my own thinking. The Big Bang was not just, remember for example, the Big Bang is not an explosion, right? The Big Bang is an expansion of space, where nothing is exploding, just space itself is expanding. So the Big Bang is as of the 1980s, was expanded to the idea of Big Bang with inflation. So inflation is this practically instantaneous inflation of space and time. So you start with a singularity, and for a very brief period in the history of the universe, there was this moment, this very brief time of so-called inflation, and space itself expands. And the best analogy that's usually given is the idea of a loaf of bread with raisins in it. So you start off with a loaf of bread of raisins, and you bake it, and the raisins stay in their same relative position when the bread is baked in the final loaf of bread, but they're much farther apart. And that's the idea of inflation. So everything in the early universe, in this case it wasn't galaxies, it would have just been clumps of matter, little clumps of matter, clumpings, tiny clumpings of particles that end up farther apart in space. That's what inflation is. It happens very quickly. Space and time, like that. Singularity to space and time. And then everything slows down, and there's really no good understanding as to... There's good understanding now with observational data, and this is observational data. This is a mapping of what's called the cosmic microwave background. And everything in astronomy hinges on the cosmic microwave background. Back in the 1980s, early 1990s, Michael Wesenberg gave a talk here to Urantia book readers called Why the Big Bang Never Happened. Does people remember that talk, Why the Big Bang Never Happened? Well, the problem was there was a signature back in the 1960s. There was a theory that if there was a Big Bang, that it would have left evidence for itself in the night sky by virtue of a kind of radiation at a certain temperature level. And by total accident, some guys at Bell Labs stumbled across it. Complete accident. It was noise. It was hiss. They were playing with early microwave transmissions, and there was this hiss in their radios. And they went to the university, what's this hiss? And these guys at Princeton, they were flummoxed. They were shaken because they knew that radiation was there, and they were trying to develop an instrument to detect it. And the guys at Bell Labs beat them to it by a matter of months and got a Nobel for it. But the guys at Princeton had the theory. Now, for 20 years, it looked totally flat at that temperature level. And a totally flat microwave background meant that there could never have been a Big Bang. I'll tell you why. And this is only this. So this cosmic microwave background is now known to be not totally flat, but there are variations to a thousandth of a degree. And this mapping is a mapping of thousandths of a degree variations. And in the cosmic microwave background, which is suggestive of matter and energy clumping, which eventually generates stars, and the clumping eventually turns into galaxies. This is important to know, because this is what modern cosmology hinges on. Where do the galaxies in the universe come from? Where do the clumpings come from that gave rise to the stars and galaxies? And the evidence for it comes out of the cosmic microwave background. As Urantiwook readers, we're stuck with that. We're stuck with the Big Bang, we're stuck with inflation, we're stuck with this explanation, and the observational evidence only gets better and better and better. So there's no... As Urantiwook talks about, there's being a problem with redshift. That could still be a problem with redshift. I mean, it could be a huge problem with redshift. But there's not a problem here. Not a problem here. So how do we make sense of the Big Bang in terms of the Urantiwook? And the only thing I come back to is the central universe is a universe, a clumping of somethings, right, with its walls of dark gravity bodies, etc. But it's in space and time, right? Central universe is in space and time, and it just appeared, right? That's the story in the Urantiwook. It just appeared. Well, the story of modern cosmology is a singularity inflating like that, and suddenly we have space and time and stuff. I don't see that as conflicting at all with the appearance of the central universe. So, yeah.
In the Urantia book, they talk about these scouts that went out into space, and so space already existed.
Right.
800 billion years ago. So
right.
The 13 to 15 billion years, I can't understand how we get that.
Right. There's some big issues, and it could be that redshift issues are hugely problematic in ways that astronomy has not stumbled across yet. Because everything that astronomy arrives at in terms of dating is based on redshift data. The Urantiwook says there's a problem with the redshift data. And I've kept my ears open for redshift issues, you know, and it's not there. No one has seen a problem with redshift issues. And we'll get to this idea of the oscillating universe, and the Urantiwook talks about a 2 billion year time cycle. Astronomers don't have a problem with the fact, you know, the Urantiwook symbol of the 2 billion year oscillation of the universe. I've asked them, one of the guys who was one of the founders of one of the greatest, I'll get to this eventually, but he said, no problem, sure, that could happen. We don't. In fact, they're looking right now for when it is that the universe began expanding again, and they don't know when. It stopped after inflation. The universe stopped expanding in a vastly quick motion. It, for some reason that's not understood, it stopped and started again. So there could be many starting and stopping points, but they've only seen one starting and stopping point. There could be multiples out there. All right, I only want to do one more thing here. Just to quickly show you something else here. Let's do that. Let's go close galaxies. Highlight. The other thing this piece of software will do is allow us not to just to see how galaxies hang on threads with huge voids in the middle, remember the Urantiwook talks about voids in space separating outer space levels, right? We all have these wonderful, simplistic images buried in our heads about motions of space. At the time that the Urantia book was written, large-scale motion was completely unknown. The Urantia book tells us a story of large-scale motion, suggests large-scale motion. You know, they might not have been able to tell us very much science-wise, but they told us a lot story-wise. I want you to see this. So here we are at this, you know, 500, 600 million light year level, and over here you can see this is called a Great Wall of galaxies, and they are, this group of galaxies is gravitationally bound together, and it's huge. It's just absolutely enormous. Outer space level, it's huge. It's absolutely huge. And it's way, way beyond what the Urantia book would call the grand universe. This is the grand universe, actually, is a very, very tiny clustering of galaxies in the very middle. That's all it is. The grand universe is a nothing, even by Urantia book. The Urantia book says the grand universe is surrounded by the first, second, third, out, fourth outer space levels, which are just progressively enormous and more enormous and more enormous. And so we know that the inhabited part of the universe of universes is tiny. It's just tiny. And, you know, it says that we are glimpsing already easily outer space levels, even with the telescopes back at that time. And this, I think, is a perfect example of the kind of clustering that is suggestive of the story in the Urantia book. But this is observational evidence. And so we have this monster wall here, and we also have this wall of galaxies that are part of the great attractor series of galaxies that are bound together that will figure into the talk. I'm going to leave this behind. We're done with this piece of software, but this... Yeah, go ahead.
So, one of my fundamental questions that remains, you might have said it already, I haven't missed
it. Oh, probably not.
So, what of the seven super universe? So, is Milky Way one of them, or not?
Actually, the Milky Way will come to... begin to think, as we talk, about a galaxy like the Milky Way as a minor sector. And from the Urantia book's description, a minor sector would be 1/1000th of a superuniverse. So there's 100 minor sectors in a major sector, 10 major sectors in a superuniverse, 1,000 minor sectors in a superuniverse. So I want you to start getting comfortable with the idea of there being about 1,000 galaxies in what the Urantia book calls a superuniverse.
Could you, in the deep space, show your understanding of the superuniverse?
We're going to get there. Yeah, let me.
So Milky Way isn't super universe. No.
Good. This is making me nuts. I hate this landscape. So this is Urantia book language. I'm not even going to bother to read it because we've just done this. I just said this. We have a minor sector is 100 so-called universes. A major sector is 100 minor sectors. A superuniverse is 10 major sectors. You know, we've seen these numbers before, but this is the issue. What do we make sense of this in relation to astronomy? And so that's what I want to get to, is fundamentally how 1,000 minor sectors really make up what we might call a super universe. I'm going to anticipate the rest of the talk. A super cluster of galaxies is on the order of thousands of galaxies. Very similar image, very similar language, super cluster, super universe, similar numbers. It's one of the things, some of the conclusions I'm going to come to here, I don't want you to see as hard and fast, this is the way it is conclusion. What I'm saying is that the Urantia book presents a cosmology that does have a relationship to modern astronomy. It may not be exactly on, this may not be dead on, but boy, there are some really close resemblances here. And in the final analysis, this may not be exactly it, but we can feel comfortable with the cosmology that the Urantia book is presenting in relationship to what modern astronomy is talking about. That's what's very cool. So that's what I'm saying here. So the brief glimpse of where we're going is that imagine the superuniverse of 1,000 minor sectors as a supercluster of 1,000 galaxies or 100 galaxy clusters. Very similar numbers. And so we had, so we ended up with the idea of Milky Way as the minor sector ENSO within, it turns out, the Virgo supercluster, analogously is about the right size to fit this number of galaxies. So when I was showing you the Deep Space Explorer and we're looking at these 28,000 galaxies clustering together, you're looking at superclusters of galaxies together in motion. And the Arentovic was suggestive of that. So again, this is important. It's not so important that there be an exact one-to-one correlation, but just that there is, that astronomy is observing galaxy collections that fit the Arentovic story. And again, we're going to come back to this. You don't have to remember this right now. So in Arentovic terms, we have master universe, super universe, et cetera. Astronomic terms, the master universe is what we simply call the universe right now. A super universe is analogous to a supercluster of galaxies, a major sector to a local group, a minor sector to an individual galaxy, like the Milky Way. And we're going to, this is, we're going to spend the rest of the talk getting back to this slide, as well as this slide. So we, in the software I showed you of Deep Space Explorer, we saw these collections of superclusters of galaxies, right? And here, I cannot believe, this is just wonderful that I stumbled across this slide. This is a colorized slide where we're at the middle of the local group of galaxies on the edge. We are in motion with the Virgo cluster and Virgo supercluster of galaxies, and we are in relation to these other superclusters of galaxies, and it turns out that these superclusters of galaxies are moving in relation to the Great Attractor. It's called the Great Attractor, and the Shapley concentration of something. So this monster collection of millions of galaxies, at least hundreds of thousands of galaxies, is in motion, and this has only been seen since the mappable since the 1980s. This is new stuff. And this region of the Great Attractor and Shapley is enormously gravitationally dominant. The problem is, it's also, you remember in the Deep Space Explorer, there was that blank area that you can't map very well. And that's the direction that the Great Attractor and Shapley are in. It's in the direction the Arrangebook says that the central universe is in. And it's in a region of space that's very hard to penetrate observationally with and get data out of because it's obscured by the Milky Way. But astronomy is able to document this motion, this enormous motion of galaxies. And it is in relation to that. And astronomy can see these concentrations of galaxies. It cannot see anything that would generate this motion of superclusters of galaxies. There is nothing there to explain why all these superclusters of hundreds of thousands of galaxies should move in relation to it. There's nothing there to explain that. Draw your own conclusion. It's just fun. It's just fun. There's a story fitting within a story here. It's fun. It's fun. Maybe this isn't where the central universe is, but why not? You know, there was a story here that could nicely fit. Bob.
Limits of revelation. Because your world is generally ignorant of origins, even of physical origins, it has appeared to be wise from time to time to provide instruction in cosmology, and always has this made trouble for the future. The laws of revelation hamper us greatly by their prescription of the impartation of unearned or premature knowledge. Any cosmology presented as a part of revealed religion is destined to be outgrown in a very short time. Accordingly, future students of such a revelation are tempted to discard any element of genuine religious truth it may contain because they discover errors on the face of the associated cosmologies therein presented.
I suspect that most of you guys are pretty familiar with the fact that there are numbers and there is science in the Arrangel book that you can question. And of course this speaks to it. And everyone has seen this, but it's important. This is real important in terms of the astronomy stuff we have to deal with here. So we know that the religious truth of most religious systems has withstood the test of time, even though the cosmologies have been lacking. We've got the Urantia book, which now talks about who is God among the galaxies, not just who is God in the heavens. So the Revelatory Commission knew that we needed a Urantia book-sized vision of the universe, and for whatever reason, in the 1920s, they knew we needed it now. because science was on the, was beginning to develop like crazy. And so, but they also realized they're going to give us a vision, but it wasn't going to stand up to the scrutiny of some science that was going to emerge. The science they give us is science in the form of story, and they throw in numbers, and some of the numbers are problematic. Source material. This is one of Matthew Block's very earliest finds. It's a book called The Architecture of the Universe. Just the name alone, the flavor of the name alone. I mean, a master architect, so, you know, I mean, it's just... When Matthew saw this title, he must have just kind of... He was, I guess, just poking around used bookstores and stumbled across this one. This was written by Swan back in 1934. How about that, huh? This is an amazing book. This is a shocking book. This book explains the theory of relativity, and it does it with mathematics, but it also is full of Swan's religious thinking. It is a wonderful, amazing book. Bob.
Architecture of the Universe, 1934. Let anyone think of a universe as complex as our own with that extraordinary cleverness and beauty of design which we observe. Let him think of the problem before him in trying to say something about it to relatively simple-minded people. He will have to give that abstract in very popular form. He will have to use analogies and the like. But you may say that it is undignified to put the truth in the light of analogies, and will claim that that which is written should necessarily be the literal truth. Alas, what do you mean by literal truth? I will venture to say that there is hardly anything which you can describe to me in which you do not unconsciously use analogies. Many of us will use quite knowingly an obsolete model for the purpose of discussing certain phenomena. One must guard against a supposed impregnable reality in many of the things which seem so obviously real to our consciousness.
Isn't it marvelous? I mean, this is a description of how exactly the Arrangel book was written. With this viewpoint in mind, you know, who was looking over whose shoulder here? Was it the Revelatory Commission looking at this guy's insights and borrowing his insights in terms of writing the Arrangel book? Or, you know, whatever it is. I mean, it's a real kick that this is it. You know, analogy, the borrowing of an obsolete model. I mean, the Arrangel book has both current and obsolete models sitting right there, but truth. You know, the facts may be a little off, but the truth is embedded within the story. Bob.
The immensity of the far-flung creation of the Universal Father is utterly beyond the grasp of finite imagination. The enormousness of the Master Universe staggers the concept of even my order of being. But the mortal mind can be taught much about the plan and arrangement of the universes. You can know something of their physical organization and marvelous administration. You may learn much about the various groups of intelligent beings who inhabit the seven super universes of time and the central universe of eternity.
So, which is an amazing statement, the fact that this order of, you know, universe intelligence staggers his imagination. What does it do to ours? And yet they give us the information anyway. Knowing that, and here's the cosmic consciousness of the weekend again, we have within us the thought adjuster, right? And the thought, and so somehow we're taking in these bits and pieces of facts and truth that we derive in the course of reading the Arrangel book, and in our superconscious realities, our thought adjusters are working with us to give us visions that are practically inaccessible to our conscious minds, that really are imparting a kind of cosmic consciousness in the course of the whole thing. So the Arrangel book is a ridiculously huge vision, but we have within us this superconscious reality that gives us some handle on something we don't even know we're getting a handle on. This is page one of The Architecture of the Universe. Page
one.
It
has always been one of the alluring games of mankind to speculate upon the why and wherefore of this universe of ours, to seek the explanation of things, the fundamental cause of it all. If the period from the dawn of history be shrunk into a day, we shall find that the first 23 hours of that day are barren, for it is only in the last hour that science was born. And even as the human child develops in its struggle, so in the last 10 minutes of its existence, In the last 35 years of actual time, it has outshone all the achievements of its youth. It has torn from nature more of her secrets than she had vouchsafed to man in the whole previous history of existence. And why has this great revelation been so long delayed?
Isn't that a cool statement? Yeah, why? You know, here we have this blossoming of science. It's just going wild as of the turn of the 1900s. It's just going wild, and you know the Revelatory Commission is standing back there, knowing they've got to say something soon. But why has it been delayed? Why did they have to wait? What was the Revelatory Commission waiting for? Now I'm going to speak to that from the point of view of astronomy. And so, you know, who are they waiting for? Who is this that they were waiting for? Yeah, it's Hubble. So Hubble was a key to why the Revelatory Commission had to wait. And why did we have to wait for Hubble? Because
that the universe was bigger than the Milky Way and contained millions of other island universes.
Yeah, this is amazing. In the time of our parents, grandparents, there was one galaxy in the universe, there was one Milky Way, the Milky Way was the universe, the Milky Way was the galaxy, all these terms meant the same thing. Universe equals Milky Way equals galaxy. And the term in common use at that time is universe. It's not galaxy. The term Milky Way is known, but they all meant the same thing. But we needed Hubble to come along and say that there is actually not just one Milky Way, but millions of Milky Ways out there. Critical image. Who is God among the galaxies, plural? And on top of that,
that space itself is expanding. All galaxies are fleeing apart from each other. The further away, the faster the recession.
So they must have needed to tell us something about not just that there were galaxies, but the galaxies really had some dynamic activities going on. That was important. So that was 1929. And so that's it. So we desperately needed Hubble. So here we have these wonderful images. You know, these are all, we instantly recognize these with modern eyes. We can look at these things and we can see barred spirals, and we can see a regular spiral galaxy, we can see elliptical galaxies. 100 years ago, the amazing thing is that these photos, which look fairly modern, were taken 100 years ago. These are 100-year-old photos. So the astronomers of the time had these amazing photos. They just didn't know what they had. They didn't know what to say about these. These were nebulae. These were gas clouds that they thought were collections of, you know, whirling gas that were giving rise to stars. That was the understanding of the time. They had photos that should have, to our eyes, told them, well, those are galaxies, but there was no evidence for them to be separate Milky Ways in their own right. They were just simply clusterings of things that looked like they were making stars. But this is Hubble's nearest by galaxy. So if you're gonna do the work that Hubble did, you're gonna choose the biggest one, the brightest one, the nearest one, and that's Andromeda. And in the night sky, this sucker would be great. I mean, I would love to show you this in the night sky. You can think about how big the full moon is. We saw the full moon last night. Superimpose this on top of the full moon that we looked at last night. The full moon is only this big. Andromeda really is this big. The moon is only this big in the night sky. If we could have seen, I mean, it's shocking to think that when we were looking at the moon last night, that Andromeda sitting on top of the moon in the night sky is many times bigger than the moon. That's how close it is to us. It's only 10 times its own diameter away from us. And they say like in 3 to 5 billion years, we're going to merge together with Andromeda. But it's that big and it's that close. I mean, it's really amazing how, you know, under dark sky you can see a little patch of fuzzy light up there that maybe is the size of the full moon, less than the full moon, but the actual extent of Andromeda is many, many, many times larger than the full moon in the night sky. It's very cool. This is really important. This is a Hubble. This is part of Hubble science. Hubble created this particular photo and annotated it. So within Andromeda, he is noting a few structures. He is seeing very common things with terms we currently use today, an open cluster. Remember how big Andromeda is. Andromeda is approximately the size of the Milky Way. This is one big, huge chunk of Andromeda, and he is noting a globular cluster. And we see globular clusters. I would have loved to have shown you one last night, but Chicago skies. Open clusters of galaxies, open clusters of stars, a Cepheid variable, a star cloud. Remember the term star cloud of Nebadon. It's mentioned three times in the Urantia book, okay? Star cloud of Nebadon. It's not an accident that the Revelatory Commission called it the star cloud of Nebadon. Think of local universe, Nebadon, star cloud, pretty big region of any given galaxy. 100 of these make up a galaxy. 100 local universes making up a minor sector. 100 whirling star clouds. I mean, you can just get the feel of it here. You can sort of imagine Andromeda consisting of 100 regions, 100 local universes of star clouds making up any given large galaxy. It's very simple. It's not complex. I think the Revelatory Commission was trying to tell us what to them was pretty obvious, but to us looks confusing. But it's not. I mean, it's right there. It's right there, 100 of these. And this is Hubble's time. This is 1920s. This is the time of the appearance of the Urantia book. This is Hubble operating at the same time, giving us a nice little mapping, calling it a star cloud, Nebadon star cloud. I don't think the Revelatory Commission was trying to do anything secretive. I think they were trying to tell us as much as they could tell us, given the science and the language that they had to use. So I have to get you up to speed a little bit more here about Hubble's work, because that's important. So in this image, if you look at this image, you see these little stars blinking off and on? A vast proportion of stars in any given galaxy are variable stars. And the Urantia book tells us that the 11-year solar cycle that we currently have with our sun, you know, the remnants of our own sun being a significant variable star in its youth. There are a particular kind of variable star called a Cepheid variable. And astronomy has used Cepheid variables since before the time of Hubble and to this time to map distances. Because all Cepheid variables have a very distinct relationship between brightness and periodicity. And a very dim Cepheid is visible in Andromeda, which Hubble was looking at back in this photograph. He's noting in Andromeda a Cepheid variable here in this photograph. It's very dim. It has all the characteristics of a regular Cepheid, but it's way too dim. And so what he ends up with is this photograph. Go ahead, Bob.
In 1923, Edwin Hubble was examining photographic plates of the Andromeda Nebula taken with the 100-inch telescope in order to find Nova, stars that would suddenly increase in brightness. On October 5, 6, 1923, Hubble located three Nova, each marked with an N. One of these nova turned out to be a Cepheid variable, a star that changes predictably in brightness, and the N was crossed out, and the star was relabeled there.
Yeah, this photograph has been reproduced over and over and over again. This is the photograph that gave us, instead of one galaxy in the universe, gave us millions of galaxies in the universe. Variable exclamation point. This discovery of that Cepheid variable being a regular Cepheid but being so frigging dim meant that Andromeda was not a simple little whirling gas cloud that was part of the Milky Way, but that it was way out there. It instantly meant that all these other little whirling gas clouds were way out there and were separate Milky Ways in their own right. This is huge. This is huge. This is huge eureka moment, huge paradigm shift. So one of the things that I think is important, and I'll introduce you to the idea now, is this image of old paradigm and new paradigm, because it penetrates the rest of my talk. The Urantia book is littered with old paradigm and new paradigm thinking. The Urantia book, when you walk into the Urantia book, the first thing you come to, I'll use this as an example because this is, it's just weighing on me. The very first thing you walk into with the Urantia book is Universal Father. Eternal Son, Infinite Spirit, Father, Son, and Spirit. The Urantia book gives us what's familiar and builds on it. It's old paradigms. I don't want to say old thinking, but it's the old paradigm. It's built off of traditional theology. And you can read the Urantia book and you can pretty much stick with the old paradigm if you want. But then you start having to stretch if you really want to penetrate it more, and you go, Eternal Son, Eternal Mother, Son? The stretches are there, and then you can take it to, you know, personality, spirit, mind, you know, the seven absolutes, the potential absolutes, the potential of mind, the potential of spirit, the potential of matter. The stretches are there. That's the new paradigm. So the Urantia book is an invitation to walk out of the old paradigm into the new paradigm. How many people do it? You know, I mean, that's it takes a while. It really takes a while. But that is the process that goes on, whether or not you realize it or not. It's an invitation into a new paradigm. But the old paradigm stuff litters the Urantia book and is an invitation. And they have to use the old paradigm to create the story, because that's what's current at the time of the writing of the Urantia book, is the old story is dominating. So a lot of the imagery of the cosmos is old paradigm, but there are suggestions of the new emerging paradigm. Hubble is the stepping stone into the new paradigm. This is important to me, and I noted at the top, this is the single most important slide in this entire presentation. It shows how the Urantia book borrows everything I just brought you up to date on Hubble's Eureka Moment. It's everything I've just taught you about variable stars, and what Hubble did is right here. Bob.
In one group of variable stars, the period of light fluctuation is directly dependent on luminosity, and knowledge of this fact enables astronomers to utilize such suns as universe lighthouses or accurate measuring points for the further exploration of distant star clusters. Why this technique? It is possible to measure stellar distances most precisely, up to more than 1 million light years. Better methods of space measurement and improved telescopic technique will sometime more fully disclose the 10 grand divisions of the superuniverse of Urantia. You will at least recognize 8 of these immense sectors as enormous and fairly symmetrical star clusters.
I was driving down the road, and I had that early collection of audio tapes, you know, this monster collection of 100 audio tapes, and I heard this driving down the road, and I went, oh my God, why haven't I seen this before? How have I overlooked this passage? This is a recapitulation of Hubble. I mean, this is exactly Hubble's work. I just described you Hubble's work. It's right here. The Urantia book quotes Hubble's work. And in the course of quoting it, they tell us that he's exactly accurate out to 1 million light years, which is the Andromeda distance. They're validating Hubble's work with Andromeda. The 1 million years that the Urantia book quotes to Andromeda is the science of the time. That's the 1 million years that was the science. And this is if it's accurate. He was entirely accurate in what he did. That's the revelatory condition, validating Hubble's work. And then they go on to say better methods of measurement, improved telescopic technique. And here's the kick, will sometime more fully disclose the 10 grand divisions of the superuniverse of Orbison. Okay, we have that now. Cepheid variables are good for nearby galaxies, but it's not good for farther away galaxies. As soon as you start getting very far, you can't see separate stars anymore in galaxies. But what you can see is stars that blow up, type 1A supernova. Those are the standard candles that science now uses to penetrate the distances, including redshift, to very far, to galaxies far away. That's the improved telescopic technique. But the kick is disclosing the 10 grand divisions of the superuniverse, or disclosing the major sectors. Where do we look to see the major sectors? How big are the major sectors? They're at least out to Andromeda and way beyond Andromeda. That's what this paragraph is saying. Andromeda is just the beginning. Andromeda is the beginning. Andromeda gives us a glimpse of the major sector. But to see the rest of the major sectors, to see the extent of the superuniverse of Orbison, we were going to have to wait until astronomy could document using these improved methods, i.e. type 1A supernova, to tell us something about all these other galaxies that comprise the superuniverse of Orbison. Therefore, the superuniverse of Orbison has to be not just the Milky Way, not just Andromeda, but way beyond Andromeda. It's right here. It's right here. Very simple. Straightforward. It's right here! And I've talked to too many science people that are getting hung up on the funny numbers, the 400,000 light years to this, the 250,000 light years to that. And I'll show you where some of that, I think, comes from. That's old paradigm. It's old numbers. It's old science. And here's the stepping stone into the new paradigm. A lot of these other funny numbers, the 1 million light years to Andromeda is old paradigm, old science. But the Urantia book is willing to say that, you know, it's an old number, but the science behind it is accurate. So here's Hubble struggling in 1938. The Urantia book is 1934. His work is the 1920s. This is 1938.
Today, the term nebula is used for two quite different kinds of astronomical bodies. On the one hand are the clouds of dust and gas, numbering a few score in all. These have been called galactic nebula. On the other hand are the remaining objects, numbering many millions, which are now recognized as independent stellar systems. These have been called extragalactic nebula. Since nebula are now known to be stellar systems, perhaps they should be designated by some other name, which does not carry the connotation of clouds or mist. The proposal most frequently discussed is a revival of the term external galaxies. The authoritative definition of galaxy is the Milky Way.
So here it's 1938, and Hubble is himself struggling with what to call these things. How did the Revelatory Commission... You know, they use the term galaxy 21 times. You know, they use the term universe is 3,000 times, because that was the term in use. Hubble was not even using the term galaxy as late as 1938. So anticipating usage was a terrible problem. I think the Revelatory Commission did the best they could. They just couldn't know that the term galaxy was going to become the term that would shift away from the term island universe. That was a very common term for these things. Island universe. But the term universe, we were stuck with it. Universe meant the whole, something big. And that's what they used. Had they known that the term galaxy was going to be used the way it is, they probably would have done it. They probably would have shifted to that if they could have. So anyway, the term nebulae comes down through centuries for these cloudy patches in the sky. The interpretation has changed, but the name has persisted. Here are these wonderful images that are drawn from modern astronomy, and they are cloudy patches that were, you know, just thought to be part of the Milky Way. Well, with our eyes right now, we can clearly see that these two are galaxies, and these two are simply planetary nebulae. But at that time, they were all called nebulae. These are still called nebulas, but they're called planetary nebulas. They're just exploded stars. But at the time the Urantia book was written, there was no way to say that these were any different than each other. They were all big collections of something that looked gassy. And so, you know, so galaxies were called nebulae, and these were called everything. It was problematic. It was really problematic, but, you know, they wanted to tell us something. The first are nebulae, etc. Here is probably the most confusing paragraph in the entire Urantia book. Here is the old paradigm, right here. This is the old paradigm. Bob.
The Urantia book refers to the Milky Way by name only 7 times. Practically all of the starry realms visible to the naked eye on Urantia belong to the 7th section of the grand universe, the superuniverse of Orvontum. The vast Milky Way starry system represents the central nucleus of Orvontum, being largely beyond the borders of your local universe. This great aggregation of suns, dark islands of space, double stars, globular clusters, star clouds, spiral and other nebulae, together with myriads of individual planets, forms a watch-like, elongated circular grouping of about 1/7 of the inhabited evolutionary universes.
This paragraph is enormously problematic because it is rife with old paradigm. This is the old paradigm. Milky Way equals Orvontum. Milky Way was the only thing out there. There was no other galaxy except the Milky Way. I didn't have anything to, you know, at the time that the Urantia book was written, everybody was still thinking old paradigm, but they snuck in little bits and pieces of things like spiral and other nebulae, which we now know are clearly galaxies, external to the Milky Way. But for those early readers, that really was what was going on. So in the old paradigm, Let me just say this. John, everyone has these posters sitting around. These are Byron's images that are, you know, based on, but it's old paradigm images. And they are tremendously useful, especially in getting familiar with the Urantia book. But what can be tremendously useful to a certain point of time becomes baggage and becomes something you need to let go of and get past. Because this image can limit your understanding right here. You can get, if you get stuck in this idea of super universe equals galaxy, then you're not getting the bigger paradigm, the bigger picture. And we've got to get past that into this fact that the super universe Warburton is much bigger than that. What else did I say here? So here's the new paradigm that I showed you a while ago of, instead of a galaxy equals super universe, a clustering, a super clustering equals super universe. The terms are not that different. So in terms of anticipating language use, maybe the Revelatory Commission came a little closer here. So anyway, I'm just mentioning, yeah, this, we just covered this. But here's the deal. It's 1934. Hubble's done all his work in 1923, 1929. You know, maybe 5 to 11 years later. Here's my question to you. How many people in this room know what completely changed another paradigm 10 years ago? What is it? If you don't have a quick answer, dark energy. The discovery of dark energy in 1998 completely transformed the understanding of how the universe is put together. No longer could the universe collapse on itself into a singularity again. 1998, this is 1998, this is a dark matter is in mid-80s. There was a demand in cosmology for two kinds of things to be operative because of gravitational observations. One is dark matter. A galaxy moves like a plate, like this. The stars on the outside move along with the inside stars. Everything moves together. Well, that's not the way a solar system operates. In the solar system, Pluto goes really, really slow, and Mercury's going really, really, really fast. Everything else in the middle is going differential speeds. A galaxy should do the same thing. Stars in the outer regions of a galaxy should be going really slow, and stars in those should be going really fast. It doesn't work that way. A galaxy goes like this. Everything moves together. Demand for dark matter. That every galaxy must be encased in, at least, that the luminous matter in a galaxy must account for, at most, maybe 5% of a galaxy. That we're only, when you look at a galaxy, you're only looking, the luminous matter only accounts for 5% of what must be there. There's got to be 20 times more stuff out there that's binding the whole thing together and make it move together. That's the demand for dark matter. That's 1980s. 1998 comes along, and we've always known that the universe is expanding per Hubble. The question is there enough matter in the universe to turn back around? Big Bang did this. Is there enough matter to eventually make it go like this and come back and collapse again? That was the search for the Hubble constant. You know, what is going on here? Is there enough matter to close the universe? 1998, two different teams are using the Hubble Space Telescope to examine supernova and discover that the supernova are not doing what everyone was assuming they should be doing. They're moving, they're not at the distances they should be at. And the data is so good that both teams within a matter of months said the universe is not just expanding, it's accelerating in its expansion. That acceleration demands that there be something within space pushing space apart. Primordial space force? Anyway. A story. The Urantia book tells us a story about space itself being real and stuff embedded in space like primordial space force. Science had no need for that at all till 1998. As of 1998, the story in science demands, and it's only story. No one can tell us, no, there is nobody out there that can tell you what dark matter, there's been a search for what dark matter might be. It's simply a term. There's a suggestion, it used to be thought that it could be machos versus wimps. The machos were given up in favor of wimps. There was a search for massive compact halo objects. Could there be massive dark things out there that make up all the missing matter? Searches said no. In the last 10 years, it's not there. So it has to be wimps. It's not machos anymore. It has to be wimps. Weakly interacting massive particles. There has to be something embedded everywhere in space that's weakly interacting, but it's massive, and that's where all the missing matter is that's binding the galaxies together. But they're two entirely different mechanisms. This mechanism is not related to this mechanism. In space, everywhere is embedded a spring-like something that's pushing space apart. And it's pushing it apart, making everything accelerate away from everything else. It can't possibly collapse back on itself. The cool thing for Urantia Book readers is, when the Urantia Book talks about an oscillating universe of a 2 billion year expansion-contraction cycle, expansion-contraction demands acceleration and deceleration, right? I mean, it's just intuitively obvious. If you've got something expanding and contracting, it's going to accelerate and decelerate. And astronomy is observing that accelerative factor right now. It's very cool. This is very cool that, you know, astronomy is looking at something that the Urantia Book demands. But here's the thing. This is 10 years later, and you guys can't really tell me what changed our perception of the universe very clearly at all 10 years ago. Well, how could those early, you know, how could the people in the 1930s, the time the Urantia Book is written, have shifted their mindset away from Milky Way as equal to the whole universe very quickly at all, especially, you know, with just newspapers? You know, who was paying attention? So the Urantia Book is mostly filled with old paradigm suggestive of how things are put together. It probably wasn't until the 40s or the 50s that people were really even getting up to speed on what Hubble was talking about in any big way. So, you know, so what I'm saying is, it's not easy. You've got to rely on old paradigm to tell the story, but try to gradually work people into the new paradigm. But the new paradigm is here. It really is here. The new cosmology is here in all kinds of ways, and I'm telling you that it's here. It's embedded. The story that we're being told contains within it suggestions of all this wonderful stuff that modern astronomy is telling us about. Okay, so this is important. Milky Way is minor sector. I'm going to have to really speed through here because it's almost 12 o'clock.
The rotational center of your minor sector is situated far away in the enormous and dense star cloud of Sagittarius, around which your local universe and its associated creations all move, and from opposite sides of the vast Sagittarius subgalactic system, you may observe two great streams of star clouds emerging in stupendous stellar coils.
So we began with that image of the Milky Way it's actually M51, which is a barred spiral. Here's another barred spiral, two great streams of stellar coils coming out of the center. This is really a wonderful verbal description of what a minor sector looks like. For most Urantia Book readers, this would simply seem to suggest, this is what in the night sky under dark sky conditions Sagittarius looks like. Well, let me back up here. Here's another image, two great streams of stellar coils. This is what the Milky Way was thought to look like up until pre-2008. This was the old image. This is the new image of what the Milky Way is now as of 2008. This is 2000, you know, a year and a half ago, 2008. This is how the Milky Way is now depicted to be, two great streams of stellar coils. The verbal image fits exactly what we now know to be the case for the Milky Way. The reason that this was not discoverable until 2008 was the same problem that we looked at with Deep Space Explorer, where you've got this big region of insufficient data. Because you have to look through the Milky Way to say something about the Milky Way, you have to look through this mass, but the Spitzer infrared scope is able to penetrate that and map it. The Milky Way was thought to be just simply a typical spiral galaxy with all kinds of arms up until just 2 years ago, and now the current understanding is two great streams of stellar coils. Milky Way, minor sector. Okay? So we're back to exactly where we started from early, and the Urantia Book says it's not so easy to identify the physical boundaries of local universes, the local star cloud of the Nevadon. This is Urantia Book terminology. Well, of course it's not easy to identify the physical boundaries of local universes because star clouds are not highly defined regions. They're not like globular clusters. So that fits. That fits very nicely. So we've already done this, and I'm having to speed through it. I'm just telling you what we've already seen here. This is just a series of quotes from the Urantia book that you can pick off on the internet that simply are more validating these images of this, you know, star cloud of Nebadon, etc. I don't really want to, we don't need to do this detail right now because we have to get to lunch. But I think you've gotten the bulk of what I really wanted to get at here, and so we're back to where we started from. Master universe in the Urantia book means simply the universe.
Yeah, that's
everything. Everything, everything. Let me tell you, just this is really, this is a, just a minor aside, but it's an important aside. We take it for granted the term universe means everything, everything, right? And that it's going to mean everything, everything for a long time to come. I mean, that just seems intuitively obvious. The reality is the term universe meaning everything, everything doesn't date that far back. And you know what? It doesn't mean everything, everything anymore. Our universe may just be one bubble in a vast multiverse. Now scientists are looking for signs that another bubble has collided with ours. Do we live in a multiverse? This is it. The guy that named, it was kind of funny, actually came, Alan Guth, is the guy that invented the term inflation and came, his eureka moment was inflation. His name is Guth, which is hilarious because the acronym for Grand Unified Theory is GUT, and his name is Guth. I mean, it was, well, whatever. But he spoke at the University of Michigan this last year, and the term multiverse is all over the place now. So the term for the biggest of all things now is it shift, it's, you know, front covers of astronomy magazines. It's now multiverse. So even the term universe is we're shifting away from that. So what the Urantia book called Master Universe, which has been the universe, is now being called a multiverse. And again, super universe, super cluster, major sector, it's kind of analogous to our local group of galaxies, and minor sector equals galaxy. So we've been there. I want to quickly do these. Bob, just read this paragraph.
Andromeda, which is outside the inhabited superuniverse, is very active. This far distant nebula is visible to the naked eye, and when you view it, pause to consider that the light you behold left those distant suns almost 1 million years ago.
Yeah, so it's always been problematic that the Urantia book is quoting million years when science has said, you know, it's got to be at least 2 million light years away. Well, here's the reason, Bob.
Architecture of the universe. Silhouetted against the sky in the constellation Andromeda is a tiny patch of light, hardly visible to the eye. It is the great nebula of Andromeda, one of the giants of the universe, a thing so large that light takes 50,000 years to cross it, but so far away that this light takes nearly 1 million years to reach us.
Right, so it's simply the science of the time that the Urantia book is recapitulating. So here is the Andromeda galaxy right here. It says it's 2.65 million light years away. You know, so had the Relativity Commission been working with current data, they might have said 2.65. Well, the crazy thing is what number would have been the accurate number? In the 1990s, it was 2.2, and then it became 2.4, and then it became 2.6. And you know what? Now it's less again, because they're discovering that Andromeda actually has remnants, a very thin remnants of Andromeda that stretch even closer to us now, that are being found out here in this region. So the number is continuously changing. So what's an accurate number? But it wasn't important to give us an accurate number because it was a story. They needed to tell us a big story, not give us accurate numbers. Here's our local group at the edge of the Virgo cluster. We don't have enough time to really do all this detail. Again, here is another image with us at the center, and we have these super clusters of galaxies in immediate relationship to our own super cluster of galaxies. This is interesting. This series of arrows doesn't represent stellar motion, it represents galaxies in motion. This kind of data was just unthinkable at the time of the science of the 1930s, this large-scale motion. The Urantia book tells us about super universes in motion in relation to each other, and then it says something about outer space levels in contrary motion to each other, it was telling us a story of large-scale motion that had no science to validate it whatsoever at the time. And this is what science is currently doing in terms of large-scale motion. And again, we're back to this slide with the great attractor sitting here, and this is the new paradigm. This is what I want you to think in terms of. Superclusters of galaxies equaling super universes in motion. So here, it's actually not that I'm trying to document that there's seven superclusters in relation to the great attractor, but it's not a whole lot different, right? This is not a whole lot different, these seven colorized superclusters moving in relationship to the great attractor. But, you know, the Rancho Book story is a real cut-and-dried, simplified story. The universe is not a cut-and-dried, simplified place. It's pretty messy looking. But this is, in an analogous, colorized way, a nice validation of that simplified story that the Rancho Book suggests. And here, you know, it just says new telescopes will see these island universes. I'm just having to blow through this. You know, here's a funny story, and we don't really have time for it. Hale is the guy. Here's Hubble sitting on his chair, which is still, if you ever go out to visit his telescope, the chair still sits there. Hubble was a crazy man. He could sit in front of this scope and guide it like crazy for hours on end, and his chair is still sitting there. He was an astrophotographer, primo astrophotographer. That's what he was really good at. He happened to be willing to stretch. And this is the guy that found the money to build the telescopes. Bob.
Taking a break to relax, Hale traveled. On his way to Egypt, he stopped at Mentone on the Riviera. One night there, when he was sitting in his room, a little man suddenly appeared to him. They began a conversation. The elf-like creature was soon advising Hale on technical matters, fundraising, and the general conduct of his life. The elf appeared to Hale often during the construction of the Mount Wilson telescope. I was looking at a picture of a man who built a telescope that allowed mankind to take the measure of the unimaginable vastness of the universe and comprehend its motion galaxies. It was only later that I learned Hale had climbed the walls at night, tortured by nightmares, until an imaginary elf helped him in his hour of need.
Pretty cool, huh? Yeah, so, you know, so the Revelatory Commission desperately needed Hubble. They also desperately needed someone to build a telescope that Hubble could use. Hale was a driven man, and this story of Hale was thought to be sort of psychotic, but you kind of wonder if he didn't have, like, helpers, you know, if he really wasn't talking to somebody, you know, a midway or somebody who was trying to help him get up to speed on getting the money together to build these major telescopes. It's very, very cool. Very cool how the universe will make use of us. Actually, here's another funny story, which I'm not going to cover. It's Harlow Shapley and Milton Humason. Humason is a road builder who built a telescope. He turned out he became an astronomer himself. His boss, who was a major astronomer himself, Harlow Shapley, refused to believe that the universe consisted of something more than the Milky Way. He wouldn't go there. He left that telescope, went on to Harvard. Hubble took his place. Hubble and Humason worked together to produce the stuff we've already talked about. Shapley finally had to throw in the towel and accept Hubble's work. But the problem with where Shapley figures into this, and what's important is of him in relation to the Rancho Book, is he generated numbers that fit the Rancho Book funny numbers. He would not go to the idea of there being something more than a Milky Way. To him, the Milky Way had to be much, much, much bigger than everybody thought it was. That the Milky Way, which you currently think of as being about 100,000 light years across, to Shapley was probably 400,000 or 500,000 light years across. The Rancho Book quotes funny numbers about the size of the super universe, the size of the Milky Way, which we know, of course, is not really the Milky Way. And the numbers are quoted are like 400,000, 250,000, and I think this guy is responsible for those funny numbers. It's the astronomers who wouldn't buy the fact that the Milky Way was, you know, that the universe wasn't just the Milky Way. I think that's where some of those funny numbers come in. It's old paradigm stuff. And so for people that are out there struggling with how to reconcile the 400,000, 250,000 numbers with the center of the super universe, it's old paradigm. It's old crappy science. It's the million years to Andromeda. And the paragraph that I gave you that recapitulates Hubble's work, that's new paradigm. That's what we really need to stick with, is that big image that a super universe must be many, many, many millions of light years out there, way beyond Andromeda. So, you know, so Hubble was kind of a funny character. He was an American who went off to Oxford. He studied at Oxford. He came back with a British accent. He dressed in knickers. He made people crazy. You know, Hale spoke to elves, and Shafley resisted seeing the obvious, and the work of the universe gets done in spite of it, you know. But the universe needs us, needs every one of us in any way we're willing to. Here's where we're running out of time. I just want to say that, go ahead, Bob. Just read this one paragraph.
The planets nearest the sun were the first to have their revolution slowed down by tidal friction. Such gravitational influences also contribute to the stabilization of planetary orbits while acting as a brake on the rate of planetary axial revolution, causing a planet to revolve ever slower until axial revolution ceases, leaving one hemisphere of the planet always turned toward the sun or a larger body, as is illustrated by the planet Mercury and by the moon, which always turns the same face toward Urantia.
Because we don't have much time, I'm just going to tell you just briefly, here's the deal, is that we know the moon always keeps the same face towards us, right? And it was always thought that Mercury kept the same face towards the sun. And this paragraph seemed to say that the moon kept its face to the Earth and Mercury was in face to the sun. They didn't have to include this paragraph. This paragraph didn't have to be here. In 1965, it was only in 1965 that it was discovered that Mercury doesn't keep the same face to the sun. Mercury has a very strange revolutionary period. And it turns out that when we look at Mercury, the times of the year when we can look at Mercury when it's elongated away from the sun sufficiently are the times when Mercury always has that same face towards the sun. In the meantime, Mercury is making a very slow dance that hadn't been observed. 1965, that recently. This paragraph accounts for that possibility. There's language in this paragraph that you can read to hear that Mercury is slowing down, that it's not doing the same thing the moon does. You can read it, Mercury is doing the same thing the moon does, or you can read it that Mercury is doing something different. And this paragraph accounts for that. And I think that this paragraph is included as a way for the Revelatory Commission to smile at us and go, you know what, we know what the score is. We really know what the score is. And we can talk about what the score is using language to fool around and, you know, into bad meanings within meanings. It's really fun. It's just fun that these things are in the Urantia book. So again, we're back to the. Well, this is a quote from the architecture of the universe. Actually, first, this is from the Urantia book.
The universe of Rabantin is illuminated and warmed by more than 10 trillion blazing suns. These suns are the stars of your observable astronomic system. More than 2 trillion are too distant and too small ever to be seen from Urantia. But in the master universe, there are as many suns as there are glasses of water in the oceans of your world.
Wow.
But the great nebula of Andromeda is only one of the million such nebula, each a little universe of its own, bound to us in one great universe by those all-pervading messengers, the light photons, which bring the story of our neighbors to us. The number of stars in the grander universe is possibly about 10,000 million million million. In other words, there are about as many stars in the grander universe as there are glasses of water in all the oceans of the world.
Source material. You know, 1,000 highest concepts. You know, in the Urantia book, they just did a great job of borrowing bits and pieces of phrases and paragraphs and reworking them into the Urantia book. And here's the great thing about this funny number. This is 1934. And he arrives at this number of 1 times 10 to the 22. This is absolutely extraordinary to me. This is 1934, and he comes up with this number. This is the Hubble. This photo was taken in 1996. The Hubble Deep Field suggests that there are about 200 billion galaxies in the universe, based on 1996. If you multiply that, let's say your average galaxy has 50 billion stars in it, That's exactly 1 times 10 to the 22. Isn't that hilarious? It's absolutely hilarious, you know, that this guy was so plugged in. Somehow, this guy was, he was such a good scientist, but he was just this wonderful character. You know, here's we've talked about the Great Attractor a little bit. If you stand in the night sky, this is what the night sky looks under dark conditions. And this is Sagittarius in the night sky. And, you know, in the south of the night sky, we do actually gaze toward the central universe as well as toward the Great Attractor. I've talked about that. I think this was the quote. Yeah, observation of the so-called Milky Way. When the angle of Vasari is propitious, gazing through the main body of this realm of maximum density, or looking toward the residential center of all things. And it turns out that the Great Attractor and Shapley are exactly in that direction. We covered that earlier. And here it is again. Looking through the Milky Way, we are looking towards exactly that. So we're at the end here. So again, what I want you to... Here's what to take away. Here's the fundamental takeaway. You don't have to learn major sectors, minor sectors. You just think minor sector and galaxy. That's a great point of departure. Minor sector equals galaxy. Local universe... as being embedded, local universes are simply these large universes, these large everythings, and it might as well be everything. We can't wrap our heads around 10 million inhabited planets. The number is so huge. I mean, it's beyond our... We think we know what we're talking about. We use the term Milky Way. We think of galaxy. We think we know what we're talking about. We don't know what we're talking about. It's so far beyond our imagination that the 100, 200, 400 billion stars in our galaxy is way beyond our imaginations. So, you know, so Michael's 10 million inhabited universe star cloud is unimaginable. But there's, imagine 100 of these within any given galaxy. And so the point here is to let go of the definitions of what you currently, you know, modern thinking, and if you can let go of your modern thinking when you read the Urantia book and try to think like they did back in the 30s, it's helpful. And Bob, this is the last quote, and this is the very, so we've had the first page of the architecture of the universe, this is the last page of the architecture of the universe.
There is one great work of art, it is the universe. Ye men of letters find, am I reading it?
Yeah.
Ye men of letters, find the imprints of its majesty in your sense of the beauty of words. Ye men of song, find it in the harmony of sweet sound. Ye lovers are conscious of its beauties in forms ye can but ill define. Ye men of science, find it in the rich harmonies of nature's mathematical design. And so, dear mortals, if ye should pray for anything, pray that ye may find senses to which all nature's beauties bring response. For then ye be as angels, and heaven shall be your habitation.
Is Swan, excuse me.
This is all Swan, yeah.
Yeah, is he recognized, widely appreciated and recognized?
I don't know. No, not. I mean, this was just another average. This would be... you know, this was your average popularizing of cosmology book from the 1930s.
Yeah.
He was just popularizing it. And, you know, if you read the rest of it, you can learn about relativity with lots of equations. You know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, that the most people that try to popularize astronomy now won't do because it's got too much science in it. But look at what else is in it. I mean, isn't that great? Yeah, that's it. Okay.